This is Building Bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
The death toll from the attack on the unarmed pro-democracy camp protesters in Khartoum, Sudan, exceeds 100, with hundreds more injured as details of tactics emerge where the reported Janjaweed militia opened fire on unarmed protesters demanding a transition to civilian rule after the ouster of President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. Paramilitaries in Khartoum threw bodies, it's reported, dozens of bodies, into the Nile to try and hide the number of dead. The Sudan Doctors Committee said the security forces had retrieved at least 40 bodies from the Nile and disposed of them. Many protesters are still unaccounted for, and the death toll is likely to rise further. Milton Alamadi, professor of African history at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and founder of the critically acclaimed The Black Star News.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm sorry we are discussing a very sad topic today, but I'm happy to be on your show as always.
This should be the top of every news item. This was Arab Spring. This was young people striking out across Sudan for exactly equal rights and justice, for the promise of democracy. But Milton, let's go back and talk about a 30-year military dictatorship led by General Omar Hassan Bashir, whom the Sudanese people sought to push out of power in April 2019. Give us the history, give us the context, give us the background.
Well, as you know, Sudan has actually experienced military rule primarily for most of its post-colonial history since its independence from Anglo-Egyptian, rather, Sudan. In 1956, the country has suffered about, I would say, five military coups since independence, the last one being, of course, Omar Hassan al-Bashir's in 1989. But in all this period, the Sudanese have really had a vigorous and well-organized intellectual class. Even during the periods of long repression, Sudan was well known for its intellectual class and vibrant activism in the 1960s and 1970s. In fact, they have succeeded, the activists, the organized professionals, including the doctors and engineers, in driving out two military dictators in the past. And this, of course, would be the third revolution successfully carried out by civilians organizing in the Sudan. And this one, of course, we know a lot more about because of social media. We're able to see the images globally in real time, so to speak. So, as you said, by April, they had succeeded in pushing out Omar Hassan al-Bashir. But, of course, pushing out the top, the head, does not mean the whole body goes with it. What transpired after he was overthrown and jailed is that a transitional committee was established, which includes senior military generals as well as the civilians that organized to push out the regime by protesting in the streets, by sitting in front of the military headquarters and refusing to leave, and really, really demonstrating remarkable courage. But it's obvious that there's now a struggle going on within the armed forces itself, between those who recognize that the civilians, the women, the young, are the ones that carry the future of Sudan. And then there are those, of course, that are vested interests, that may fear retribution for the crimes that they committed during the Bashir regime, including Bashir himself. So now there's reports that the forces that carried out the atrocities are those who were associated with the Janjaweed in the past. the forces that committed the horrific massacres during the Darfur conflict that began in 2003 and continues, although at a diminished level, up today. So there are indications that those are the forces that may have carried out the massacre. Obviously, those forces were loyal to General Mohamed Dagalo, who I believe is the number two person in the transitional authority that is supposed to be running the country right now. And General Dagalo, of course, was himself close to al-Bashir. So there could be an element of Bashir loyalists also involved in this horrific massacres going on in the streets of Khartoum.
Let me just stop you there for a moment.
We'll
pick up that thread. I just want to go back to, for a moment, the idea that these were initially the protests characterized as quote unquote bread protests.
Yes.
Bread, which you've pointed out to me, is of course a major staple, especially
correct.
In the urban areas. And it began to take on a more political tone when the professional classes, the doctors
yes.
and so on, got involved. But we've seen through social media the enormous presence of women taking
yes.
a prominent role. And I wonder if you can just parse out a bit more for us. You did mention, you know, that it's always been a kind of vibrant intellectual class
yes.
there.
Mm-hmm.
But how the coalescence of people who surely understood that they were risking their lives, that
yes.
groups like the Janjaweed were lurking in the background and
yes.
had committed genocides.
Yes.
How is it that they were able to really mobilize? Do
yes.
you have a sense of what really kind of crystallized or was the essential catalyst that brought this enormous democracy movement to the forefront now after 30 years of this brutal dictatorship?
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, the economic aspect was very, very critical. The country has a debt burden of more than $10 billion U.S. dollars. The country's revenue stream shrunk dramatically, as you know, after the South separated and became independent nation of South Sudan after the referendum of 2011. And that was not surprising because the war between the southern part of the country and north, basically Khartoum, where you had this dictatorship which was basically promoting the fundamental Sharia to govern the entire country, that had always been the main issue of conflict between the north and the south. So when the south broke off with it, it went with most of the oil fields that happened to be in the southern part of the country. So the country lost, I believe, more than 60 to 70% of its income from oil exports. So as a result of the diminished revenue stream, the debt went up dramatically, economic conditions worsened, inflation escalated, the price of bread, which is a major staple in the urban areas, tripled. While the size itself shrunk by more than 50%, you needed special permits in order to buy certain quantities of bread. So everybody saw that, you know, the future could not be sustained by the current regime. There was a need for change. People could not survive if they didn't have relatives overseas who were actually sending them medication and money on a regular basis. So the economic conditions were one of the issues. But then in terms of why did the youth, why did the women come out in dramatic numbers? Partly because they saw that it was being covered globally. It was being covered globally because of the effective social media organization that they were able to do. And when they saw that, that obviously emboldened them as well. They got the indication that the whole, much of the world at least, was standing with them and rooting for them and cheering for them and supporting them. And that still remains true. And of course, times are changing in Africa, all out throughout Africa, because Africa happens to have the youngest population in the world. So you saw very young people coming out, young ladies, young women coming out on the streets. They know that it is time for them to seize their destiny. And they know they will succeed. I must say that, because they've always succeeded in the past when they came out of the streets in pushing out these dictators. I think what we're seeing right now is sort of a counter-revolution, but I don't think it's going to succeed. And it's primarily being driven by foreign elements, primarily Saudi Arabia. And why is that? Because Saudi Arabia had a pact with the military regime to supply them with young men, young Sudanese who are being recruited and given literally pennies, but under dire circumstances, this money is welcomed by their family. Some are being forcefully recruited and sent to fight in Yemen on behalf of Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia does not want to lose the fodder that it's currently recruiting from Sudan to fight its genocidal war in Yemen. Saudi Arabia will go to any cost, including trying to undermine the revolution in Sudan, in order to keep this pipeline open of young men to fight its war in Yemen.
We're going to continue to look at the role of Saudi Arabia, but I then want to backtrack again for a moment and just to parse out the issue of the military. You've described certainly some of the issues relevant to the Janjaweed, who was the same militia responsible for the killing of hundreds of thousands of Sudanese in Darfur.
Correct.
Which is occupying the capital of Khartoum.
Correct.
But talk a little bit more about who they really are and the complexity of the role that the military has had in relationship to Bashir and where the Janjaweed fits in. I mean, this is the militia and there is the military. So maybe how do they kind of coalesce and how do you think they ultimately break out since they certainly the military reneged on all of the talks and agreements before opening fire on unarmed protesters?
Okay, I think you've actually, in posing your question itself, you captured the essential element. How do they coalesce? I don't think they ultimately coalesce at the end of the day. I think there are professional soldiers who are trained and the ones who are responsible for pushing out Bashir. Because somebody had to make the decision that no, you know, he is no longer part of the future. We must arrest him. So I don't see those same generals who made that decision to arrest Bashir, bringing back the Janjaweed elements to govern the country. It's just not possible. So to me, I think there's a clear indication that there's a power struggle. And the Janjaweed, as you said, are one of the many militias created by Bashir, because obviously he must have conceived of a day like this, where he might need other militias to come and back him if he was having divided loyalty within the armed forces. So he possibly foresaw a day like this that he would need extra paramilitary forces that he could command or that might remain loyal to him to come to his assistance. So this could be one of those moments where we see this power struggle going on within the leadership of the army. But the army was already under tremendous pressure. It was already actually scouting out and casting a wide net hoping to attract civilians to help them manage the economy because the country is facing economic collapse. The military leadership was aware of that. So it means that the military leadership is actually probably supporting a transition to democracy and civilian rule in the Sudan. In fact, even after these massacres, the military leadership is now calling for elections within 9 months and continued talk with the civilians. But of course, the civilians cannot trust anybody associated with the military today because they really don't know who is behind ordering these massacres. So obviously the talks must continue, but there has to be outside neutral mediators involved in any potential future talks. I would not blame the civilians right now not to trust a single person associated with the military. And also conscious people like us here in New York people, what we can do is actually Google and look up the phone numbers for the missions of Russia, its permanent mission to the UN, and the permanent mission of China to the UN. Please Google their phone numbers and call them and ask them, saying you're calling as a concerned global human citizen who's outraged by what's going on in Sudan. So why are they blocking action by the United Nations Security Council, even in terms of making a strong statement and making demands for an end of these massacres? So please, that's the very least we can call. And I think if dozens and dozens of people start calling, they will get the message, and they will know that people that care about the Sudan around the world are watching the atrocities and want to expose anybody or any country involved in supporting these massacres.
And we're speaking with Professor Milton Alamadi, who is the founder of the all-important The Black Star News. And now I want, again, to pick up the thread that we left a moment ago, the issue of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates as well, providing or seeking soldiers to provide for its war in Yemen, which, of course, has the dollar signs and support for the bombings of the U.S. all over it as they destroy the civilian population in Yemen. So I want you to talk a bit more about that, and also a major concern, which you've certainly raised and studied for years and alerted us to, the question of perhaps the impact of this and similarities of the way Uganda, under dictator General Yoweri Museveni, is involved, and what the implications are for this.
Right, of course. Yeah, that's a proper analogy, because what the Saudis and UAE and Saudis primarily actually have a sort of a neo-colonial relationship with Sudan at the moment, similar to what the United States has with Uganda under the dictatorship of Yoweri Museveni, where Museveni basically has deployed as many as 10,000 Ugandan soldiers to Somalia to fight on behalf of the U.S., because the U.S. fears that Somalia would become a haven initially for al-Qaeda, and then at some point perhaps for ISIS as well. But Museveni plays up that Islamic fundamentalist threat in Somalia, and in order to create that a pact, sort of the U.S. has a pact with the devil in Uganda, where it ignores human rights abuses in Uganda. Museveni's dictatorship itself, not by coincidence, has been there for 33 years. So in Sudan, we have a similar relationship between Saudi Arabia and the military dictatorship there, and it seems that the Saudis want this relationship to continue even during this period of transition. And I think the ultimate fear, of course, is that if you have a democratic, accountable, elected government in Sudan, there's no way could that relationship be maintained. And as far as the war in Yemen goes, in the last several recent months, it is primarily because of the young recruits from Sudan that this war has been able to be maintained. So they see that as a very important component of this war that they're pursuing in Yemen. And of course, the U.S. plays a role here, because as we saw in Egypt, the Saudis and Egyptians are supporting General Khalifa Haftar, who controls much of the east of Libya. And in the U.S. at one point was actually supporting the United Nations recognized government in Tripoli, the capital. But recently, the Saudis had a conversation, it was reported, with Donald Trump. And as a result, the U.S. seems to now have switched its support and has endorsed the attacks that have been unleashed by General Khalifa Haftar, backed by the Saudis, causing as many as 500 deaths recently in Tripoli. So now we see that same kind of reconfiguration occurring in Sudan. The U.S., I don't believe, has been as forceful as it could be following these massacres, or made it very clear that the people that are behind these killings will be held to account. And why is that? I think because the U.S., at least Donald Trump, will end up siding with whichever direction Saudi Arabia wants to pursue in Sudan. And I think that's very, very dangerous, because if the revolution in Sudan is allowed to collapse, the alternative is going to be civil war. And we don't need that, because South Sudan right now, neighboring South Sudan, is gripped in a very violent civil war. So trying to imagine a situation where we have Sudan itself in full-fledged civil war, we have civil war in South Sudan, it won't be contained. It would then spread likely even to Ethiopia and, of course, across the border from South Sudan into Uganda. That's a scenario that I don't even want to contemplate or to imagine. That is why it's very important that the military moved out of power in Sudan and the civilian authorities and the revolution allowed to continue and to succeed in the Sudan.
And I can't help but remember that certainly when it comes to Museveni, Uganda's dictator, that the U.S. military has trained
regime's
forces to the tune of at least $750 million annually. So
absolutely,
we see the fingerprints and the interests of Washington in the region, which
absolutely
makes the events in Sudan of such a critical import and nature. So as we progress in our time zone here and our winding up this segment, you mentioned some things to be done, but I do want to explore one of the things that I still find, which is different than Arab Spring, etc., because here the protesters are calling for a general strike. The issue of the working class as a whole coming into play is these are protesters. These are protesters for bread and roses. But there's certainly protesters who have a wider political consciousness that understands the issue of the working class and the control of the means of production. Can you talk about that also as an element of the political consciousness that is on display there? And then, of course, what, again, we should do to support the protest movement that, despite the atrocities, is flourishing politically in its ideology to move for the promise of democracy in Sudan.
Well, I like the way you set it up just perfectly in terms of bringing out the working classes. Anybody associated with any labor organization listening to this here in New York, please, please respond to my urging that you pick up the phone after you find out the numbers. Google the phone number of the Russian permanent mission to the UN and China's permanent mission to the UN. Call them and express your outrage and tell them not to stand in the way of the UN Security Council making a forceful statement and considering any other action that is necessary to support the young activists, the brave activists, who have now lost more than 100 of their compatriots in the Sudan. So that's one aspect. You ask why. It's very interesting. Sudan has always had a very interesting and vibrant, conscious intellectual class throughout its history, reading and discussing and debating Western neoliberal economics versus socialist and even Marxist economics. So, and you find very conscious people who understand the role that the global economy and institutions like the IMF and the World Bank plays in determining the fate of so many, many, many people around the world and certainly all of Africa. So that's always been a part of the debate in Sudan, so unique compared to many, many African countries. And as I said, as a result of that, they've always had a very powerful, organized professional class, whether it's the teachers, whether it's the doctors, whether it's the ordinary workers, clerical workers in Khartoum. That's always played a very significant history in any change in the Sudan. And as I said, they were successful in pushing out at least three dictators in the past, and I don't see them failing this time, especially in the era of social media when their activism is much more amplified and seen around the world. So I'm very confident that they will succeed. Obviously, we don't want it to happen with any more bloodshed.
And I will end with really your own words, which is explaining and saying how dangerous the situation is that needs not and must not deteriorate further. There's a bloody civil war raging in South Sudan. The last thing the region needs is another conflagration that then spills into Uganda and Ethiopia. And I can't thank you enough, as always, for helping us understand what underlies the conflict and bringing to the fore the issues of Africa for those who understand the significance, the importance, the history, the magnificence of the African continent and the politics that are unfolding there, which I may remind were some of the major triggers, catalysts, the anti-colonialist struggles and struggles of national liberation throughout the African continent that actually propelled our own movements for equal rights and justice and democracy forward.
Yes, absolutely. I always appreciate this opportunity. And you also posed a very serious question. Why aren't more journalists writing about this? Write about the revolution in the Sudan. Seeing those young people, they share the kind of hopes and dreams and aspirations that you right here in New York, in the United States, also aspire and hope for. So side with them. If you're a journalist, write about their struggle.
And indeed, as Milton Alamadi told us, call the permanent mission of the Russian Federation, the permanent mission of the People's Republic of China, the Russian Federation, 212-861-4900, the People's Republic of China, 212-655-6100, and tell them what, Milton, in the final moment?
The people were behind the revolution in Sudan. Why are you siding with dictatorship and the past? Embrace the future, and the future is now.
Professor Milton Alamadi, who is the founder of the Black Star News. Check it out. Check it out if you haven't. Thank you so much for joining
us. Stay strong, as always.
Peace.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.